Tony and Jenny Brewski here from Real Ghost Stories Online. There has never been a better time than now to be an EPP, extra podcast person, to Real Ghost Stories Online.
There's more exclusive content than ever before.
Plus, our new EPP website is up and running where you can access all of our exclusive content anywhere you want on any device. Exclusive video, all of the archived episodes, it's all there when you sign up to be an EPP at realghoststoriesonline.com.
It's only $5 a month.
And that goes to keeping our show on the air and alive. Sign up now, become an EPP, and enjoy all of the bonus episodes for yourself when you sign up at realghoststoriesonline.com. Just click Become an EPP.
Welcome to Real Ghost Stories Online. Call in your real ghost story now at 855-853-4802. Or write in at realghoststoriesonline.com. You are about to enter the world of the unknown, and quite possibly, the undead. This is Real Ghost Stories Online.
And on today's episode of Real Ghost Stories Online, we're going back in time all the way, starting with episode number one of Real Ghost Stories Online. Today's episode is going to feature some of our favorite interviews ever done on this show. And we are going to go back to our very first episode for the beginning of the show today to talk with writer and director and producer Eric Walter, who created the film My Amityville Horror. Okay, this was the look inside the mind and the life of one of the children who went through the experience of the Amityville Horror. Very, very interesting interview. It was the interview that kicked off our show almost 2 years ago now. And one, if you've never heard, very, very compelling and interesting. I know this has dropped off iTunes now, but we're going to bring it back for you to take a listen to today if you've ever been interested in the topic. Or maybe you've already heard this show and this episode a long time ago. It's always one of those that is interesting to take another listen to years later. I know I always like to go back and listen to some of those old interviews back with Art when he was talking with George Lutz when he was alive. Just some very, he was going to pick up new pieces, if you will, from the puzzle that is the Amityville Horror. And who would have ever thought another chapter that would ever come about after George and Kathy had passed, with the children now coming out and speaking about their experiences. So we'll kick off today's episode with a look back at that and our interview with Eric Walter, the director of My Amityville Horror, today on Real Ghost Stories Online. Eric Walter is a writer, director, and documentarian and creator of AmityvilleFiles.com, which is one of the definitive online sources on the subject. This is his interview. This is him with us sharing his thoughts on exactly what happened in that interview and what happened inside that house at 112 Ocean Avenue. Eric, welcome to the show. I got to ask, what made you interested in this topic to begin with?
When I was about 10 years old, I became totally enamored with the book by Jansen, The Amityville Horror.
Sure.
And I guess primarily because a true story was printed on the front cover.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, it was that black cover with the devil's tail and the flies and all of this. And so I was just very obviously taken by the entire story, the allegations of a haunting. Obviously, the mass murder that had been, occurred in the house in 1974 at the hands of the oldest son. All of these things under one roof very much intrigued me. And in many ways, Amityville kind of represents, America's, if not the world's, most famous and infamous haunted house controversy.
Mm-hmm.
So I, over the subsequent years, became very interested in almost an Amityville obsessive, I guess, to the point that I was, looking into records of the Historical Society, taking trips to Amityville. I had to take photographs and meet people who worked on the case. I actually subsequently, became, you know, friends over the phone with people like Laura DiDio, who was an investigative reporter and actually a news assistant for Channel 5 News at the time of these occurrences that happened to the Lutz family. And so, upon this, I was just very driven with the story and very passionate about it. I developed a website, kind of what I would describe as a web archive called AmityvilleFiles.com, which is kind of a treasure trove, a creative presentation of a lot of the documentation that surrounds the story, a newspaper archive and things that I've collected through friends and people I've met online over the years. And so, it was just a process of trying to create somewhere people could go and pull their own conclusions about what they believe happened in that house. And there are so many different theories about what happened in that house. It's very easy to say that what the Lutzes claimed happened was all a hoax and none of it ever happened. But I really think that the truth of the matter lies somewhere between it being fabricated and it being an out-and-out truth.
Before you made the film, where did you feel that the truth actually lay on this haunting story? I know you said somewhere in the middle, but be a little bit more specific as to where you kind of feel things had been or where they were sitting in reality before you talked with Daniel.
Well, for me, obviously, it was just a story before I met with Danny. I had always just, read. It was all of what I had read and talked to. I'd never actually spoken to any of the family members. So my gut instinct was, even before meeting Danny, that there was some truth to it. That, obviously, I don't think a family abandons all of their worldly possessions and runs from this house and flees clear across the country over nothing. Mm-hmm. While I do think that, there were very many things that have been said about this house, I don't believe everything that's been said by the Lutzes, by the media, and a lot of the truth has become misconstrued about what actually they said, and that's the actual, shame of this entire case, that it's been clouded and lost in so much misinformation over the years. To develop a real well-rounded opinion about it, honestly, you have to dig through all the muck that surrounds the story, and that includes the DeFeo case, and the subsequent families who lived there who said nothing ever happened to them strange and there's nothing to the story and, this is all just a big hoax. I just think that's too convenient of an answer. I believe something definitely of a genuine paranormal nature did happen to the Lutz family. However, I do think that it snowballed into something now that it never actually represented. And there's been so much said about it. Mm-hmm. It's now America's most famous haunted house.
Sure.
And then, in many ways, there's been many hauntings that have happened to other people in many ways that are more severe and I think a little bit more, I guess, powerful in nature than the Amityville case. For some reason, I think the mass murders enhanced that idea.
How did you begin communicating with Daniel?
So through Amityville Files, I was contacted one day out of the clear blue sky by a friend of his in the Queens area, who said he knew Danny and Danny was interested in talking publicly. However, he wanted to speak with somebody who knew the case and didn't want to have to educate somebody on all of the story that surrounds it.
Have any of the other children, because obviously there was other children in the house when this happened, have any of them ever come forward with any pieces of information?
Yes, Christopher Corotino, who is Dan's brother, actually has spoken publicly in various venues, similar things that Danny actually claimed to me, and in the film, of course, that his stepfather, George Lutz, was involved in occult dabblings inside the house, and they believe triggered the haunting on the family. Now, of course, I don't want to speak for Christopher because that's not my job. It's not my job to speak for anybody but myself, of course, but this is widely known and something that I was obviously familiar with once I met Danny. George passed away in 2006. To be making allegations about someone who now is gone was definitely a concern to us filmmakers, just to be, very careful to how to tread on that area.
Sure.
However, Danny's story is wrapped up in the memory of the stepfather and what he feels the stepfather perpetrated on the family.
The talks of George being involved in the occult, that was the first time I had heard it was in your film. I was unaware that the other brother had talked about that as well, other than Danny talking about it in your film and the other brother having mentioned this over the years as well. Did George ever make any references to him being involved in the occult in his later years? I know he was doing some interviews, but I had never heard.
Not to my knowledge, yeah. No. And he'd been interviewed at the Times, actually, as a clip in my film about with George and Kathy are sitting on Good Morning America.
Sure.
They're asked, you know, flat out, were you interested in the believers in the occult? And they both say no.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the film, you know, juxtaposed with Danny talking about George being involved with satanic ritual and having books on.
I know there had been a lot of stories towards the end of George's life when he was doing interviews, and I don't know if you've heard this either, where the people who were scheduled to interview George when he was granting some of those, prior to him speaking to them, strange things, events would be happening to the folks that were going to be interviewing. Now, they weren't tragic or anything like that, but just kind of unexplained, odd things, accidents around individuals prior to that. Had you ever heard of anything of that nature?
I can't say that I have. And for, I wish that I would have been able to speak with George personally.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have the, you know, a good fortune, many people did, to speak with him, but I certainly would have pursued to get his point of view in this project. In many ways, I feel I wish something of a first-person documentary nature, like we did with Danny, could have been done with George, because mm-hmm. that was honestly what needed to be done.
Sure.
It would have been an entirely different film.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I haven't heard those stories. I think a lot of your, you know, the paranormal, at least from my opinion, hauntings, you know, you can be very susceptible to a haunting.
Mm-hmm.
If you believe in hauntings, if you believe in evil,
mm-hmm.
then obviously it's going to be enhanced more. George, I know at the time, claimed that he was a non-practicing Methodist when they moved into the Amityville house.
Mm-hmm.
And neither George nor Kathy were overly religious.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, of course, moving out of the house, they definitely became much more involved in the church. So these allegations of George being involved in the occult and you know, satanic rituals and this type of thing seemed very, obviously, the anger towards the stepfather from Danny,
mm-hmm.
I felt many of his statements were colored by his anger.
Sure.
And, you know, obviously, the need to put the blame on someone, I was always wondering what that is. Of course, that's my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I really wanted the film to speak for itself and for Danny to have, you know, film allowed room to breathe a little bit in that way,
mm-hmm.
For people to make up their own mind, because my job as a documentarian is to be objective with the content.
Sure.
And I really think our film, because we're dealing with a boy who was 10 years old at the time, we're dealing with someone who the memory of the event now is mixed with media interpretations of the occurrences,
mm-hmm.
by no fault of his own, in my opinion. And I think that it's unfortunate, because what the film represents for me is kind of the fuzzy line between reality and imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's unfortunate. Obviously, like I said, I would love to have talked to George Lutz,
mm-hmm.
But the story that I was able to capture and extract from somebody who was there, obviously, who'd never spoken publicly about this,
mm-hmm.
and none of the kids have to this degree. This is the first time this has happened in such a, you know, a feature type of presentation. You know, it's a sad and tragic picture. Danny was a victim, and I wanted to show the utmost respect for him to come forward. And obviously, you know, we had many discussions, you know, it was the process of making the film. I kind of had to, you know, befriend Danny,
mm-hmm.
and tell him, you know, this is, you're sure you want to open this door, because once, you know, if you're not identified as the Amityville kid now, you certainly will be once this is out, you know, now as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's a very difficult picture. And there's been so much said about this case, and for someone who was an adolescent at the time to now try to move forward and rationalize something unexplainable to a public who's already mired in decades of misinformation, you know, it's a very difficult picture. It's not the easiest of prospects.
Did anything odd occur throughout the making of this film, whether it be, you know, something slight or something major? Did you have anything strange happen to you or any of your crew?
I can't say that I did. I know that when we were shooting at Lorraine Warren's occult museum, and we had Danny and everyone, that was, I know some of the camera operators and things were a little unnerved because I think the surroundings. Mm-hmm. And it was a little bit of an uncomfortable shoot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think I would mainly attribute that to Danny's intensity.
Mm-hmm.
And how he dealt with that entire situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because by the, you know, it was a difficult process of getting Danny to want to talk about this
sure.
at all, honestly. I mean, he wanted to come forward to connect with me, but it wasn't like he was open and he was open for Danny, and I appreciate that from him. But I still look at the film and I'm flabbergasted that we were able to get as much as we did on camera mm-hmm. and in the can in an editable fashion. But no, I can't say that anything of a paranormal nature occurred to me or my crew while we were shooting it. Thank God.
Okay. Yeah. What were your when you first got to sit down with Danny, before the cameras came in, when you actually had the tape recorder and you went in and you met with him, what were your first impressions of Danny?
Just a overly angry, just person. I mean, my first meeting with him was at a diner in Queens.
Mm-hmm.
And I went there, and his very first question he asked me was, you know, what is your religion? I brought a digital recorder with me about a collection of photographs from the March 6, 1976 investigation. And you could feel the years kind of coming off his chest.
Mm-hmm.
He was sitting across from me, kind of, you know, chain smoking cigarettes. It was a powerful thing. By this point, we were we weren't in the diner. We were somewhere. You know, we were in his place, so it was mm-hmm. fine. But it was a private thing. But it was, you could definitely feel, you know, some of these photographs he had never seen before. Some mm-hmm. photographs of his bedroom, his toys on the shelf,
mm-hmm.
The furniture they left, the clothes. You know, and it was obviously an emotional thing for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt then that, you know, kind of my initial skepticism of this being something he was doing for attention or money or something kind of dwindled away at that point, because I realized this was almost like a cathartic sense of settling a score with himself
mm-hmm.
that he needed to, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, you know, exorcise the demons of his past. That was the process of what that was all about.
When you brought the photos to him, obviously one of the most infamous photos of the case is the Ghost Boy photo.
Right.
Did you ever get his opinion on that photograph in particular?
Unfortunately, not on camera. I do have it on audio cassette, and he did talk about how he believes that it's credible, that he believes that it was something. My own opinion, actually, we've done quite a bit of friends of mine have done some research on this over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's quite a bit of debate on that picture. I mean, it does represent a fellow who was actually brought in assistant to the warrant named Paul Bartz, who was in the house at the time. And there's a lot of speculation whether that was actually him, because if you look closely, you can see that whatever figure is peering around the corner is wearing, appears to be a plaid, you know, like a flannel shirt,
mm-hmm.
It appears to be eyeglasses that, you know, when you look at it from just looking at the photograph, not up close, it looks like luminescent eyes.
Sure.
So what's more likely here, I don't know. But this camera was on a timer. It was a camera on the second floor
mm-hmm.
Set up by Gene Campbell, who was hired by the Warrens to be there that night. And, there was just so many different photographs being taken at the time. Mm-hmm. And so that was just one that was found by George's secretary, I think, around after the book came out initially in the late 70s.
Because it certainly is one of the most eerie, whether it's real or not, ghost photographs that have ever been published.
Laura DiDio actually told me that, you know, I won't go as far as, obviously I don't want to speak for her.
Sure.
She, you know, she's told me that she feels, you know, she knows there were no children in the house.
Yeah.
She doesn't know who that is or what that is, and I guess I get the sense from her that she believes that it actually was of some sort of, you know, specter in the house. If you look at photographs of one of the DeFeo children, it has a striking resemblance to them.
Really?
Which is pretty chilling as well. Yeah.
There been, all I know from the research that I've done is that is the only photo that seemed to show anything paranormal or relatively paranormal. Is there any other photo evidence or anything of that nature that has ever come out that showed anything odd?
Nothing from the time. I know there's about 3,000 photographs of reflections on windows of
mm-hmm, sure.
people driving up and taking pictures that, you know, some of those are very, very odd, obviously, but I wouldn't say that there's certainly no proof, you know, concrete proof. There, well, actually, I'm missing over one thing. That actually is briefly mentioned in the film, but never really, it's never really pinpointed. There's the infamous moose head photograph that was taken, again, by Gene Campbell in the house during the investigation. And it's a photo of Lorraine Warren, who at the time was holding an icon as Padre Pio, who was, you know, St. Pio was a saint at the time. And she had received this icon before going into the house and had this with her during the investigation. And, you know, I know that George and Lorraine and others believe there's actually a formation of Padre Pio's face, which is quite striking. It looks very much very similar to photographs of, you know, the side of Padre Pio's face in the moose head itself.
Really?
There's different pictures, yeah, that represent, actually look like a face. But I think, again, I hate to be a pessimist, but for me, it looks very much like it could just be a formation in the actual moose's head. But it's one of those things. There definitely is no concrete proof or evidence for any of it that's been captured on camera, other than those two intriguing photographs.
In the film that you made, towards the end, you ask Daniel about taking a lie detector test, and he obviously seems almost offended by the question. I'm sure it's something he's been asked many times in the past, too. Why do you think it was that he reacted the way he did?
Well, I could answer that simply. I think he took it as an assault on his credibility. He had sat there for 8 hours, and I had allowed him, without confrontation, without me pushing any, you know, any buttons, and me asking a question about a lie detector test was not me trying to, you know, it was not a, I guess you'd say, a gotcha question or something like that. It was really a valid question. I actually prefaced the statement with, you know, in 1979, George and Kathy, your parents, took lie detector tests and passed with flying colors. And this is true. You know, they were asked questions like, did you levitate? Did you see yourself as an old hag in terms of for Kathy? And yes. And they, again, passed with flying colors. So I think it was a valid question. Your parents did this. Would you be willing to do this? And he took it, again, as an assault on his credibility from the standpoint of he had sat there for 8 hours, poured his heart out, essentially, to me, and in front of, you know, three other camera operators whom he didn't know at all. And, you know, it was an intense, I mean, he's clearly visibly shaken in the film and quite disturbed by the entire topic. And so, you know, it wasn't my intention to get elicit such a reaction out of him. However, I do think I did include it in the film at the end, because I think that it keeps the question of whether this was a fabrication or whether this was the truth right on the line, because at the end of the day, that's all we're left with. The truth is unattainable in this case. There were only five people in that house who can corroborate their stories. And George and Kathy are now passed over. Of course, we have their story documented in so many different, you know, formats, venues that have been, you know, over the years. And this is the first time Danny is coming forward. Christopher's talked about it. I know his sister wishes to remain private, and, you know, I think everybody respects that and understands that. She was very, very young at the time. So I don't know. I mean, it's unfortunate. So I think the state of the case today is, in many ways, Danny represents the living embodiment of everything that's been wrong with his story in a lot of ways. Because of the memories that I talked about, well, the film goes into heavily the idea that his memories are skewed by media versions of the events. And that's unfortunate. However, I do believe many of the things he talks about are genuine and that he does remember these things. But also, we're talking about a child's perception on something that's been, you know, over 35 years ago now.
Sure.
And so it's a very, very difficult picture, and obviously a sad and tragic portrait of someone who's been, you know, psychologically damaged by something that he essentially was indoctrinated into at a very early age.
That's
the real Amityville horror for me.
Was there anything that Daniel told you that made your opinion of the truth about the Amityville horror sway one way or the other?
I would say that the light that's been shined on the family dynamics of the story really, you know, gave me pause for thought, because in so many ways Danny's story is mixed. He's almost haunted by his stepfather George. I mean, a lot of his claims of the supernatural are mixed or interlaced with his statements about the stepfather, which kind of, for me, it's you know, I mean, I don't want to say the same is true for Christopher, because we haven't heard his entire story, but in a lot of ways, you know, making statements about George perpetrating the haunting or instigating the haunting on the family, I guess says a lot about that perception of how they view that time in their life. You know, for me, you know, their natural father was removed from the picture and replaced by someone who was an ex-Marine, and obviously, by all accounts, I was able to talk to a very domineering personality.
Mm-hmm.
And so, without trying to make allegations towards someone I never met, which is, you know, obviously the problem here, everyone was kind of unnerved by him.
Mm-hmm.
That I was, even Lorraine Warren, who speaks in the film about him, was kind of put off by him.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it's a difficult topic to step forward into in that area, especially since, but, you know, since it's such a contentious, it's already such a contentious controversy.
Since the film has been completed and is now out, have you been in contact at all with Danny, and have you gotten his feedback on the film?
Yeah, actually, yes. I say yes. Just a couple days ago, when the film actually finally was released theatrically and on video on demand, he called me to congratulate me and thank me for helping him get his story told. And that, obviously, is probably the highest praise I could, as a filmmaker, could ever receive.
Sure.
Especially when it's such a sensitive topic about someone. You know, the film's about him, and it hasn't been an easy process because Danny put an extraordinary amount of trust in me,
mm-hmm.
which I greatly respect and obviously appreciate. So, you know, yes, he's seen the film. He's happy to have gotten this off his chest. Again, I keep saying it, but I don't want to speak for him, but... hopefully, at some point, he'll be willing to step out and talk about it publicly again.
Mm-hmm.
I know he told me when we started this project, he was not interested in having, you know, thousands of press interviews and this type of thing. That he wanted to tell this one time and be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what we're left is right now. And so he and I are on a very cordial level.
What do you personally want people to take away from this film?
I want people to remember that, you know, it's easy to call the story a hoax and that this was all, you know, some sham created by the Lutzes for money. However, I don't think someone who goes through this and you look at Danny and you look at his reaction, you don't end up that way over nothing. There was definitely something that happened to these people that was earth-shattering and completely has shaken up their lives. And the idea that someone's living in the shadow of something for the rest of their lives is something that kind of transcends Amityville. It talks about anybody trying to explain or rationalize the unexplained
mm-hmm.
to the public. And I think that's kind of, a topic that really hasn't really been given serious consideration before. So I really wanted to do something new with a case that really has been mistreated in the media for so many years. And I wanted to do it respectfully, but also, you know, we have to tell a story at the same time. So I think it does all of those things, and hopefully will open people's eyes to the reality of these events.
Eric, thank you for talking with us at Real Ghost Stories Online. Be sure to check out his website, AmityvilleFiles.com. A very, very comprehensive look at the murders, at all the investigations that have been done. It probably is the preeminent site or really just plethora of information anywhere on the topic of the Amityville Horror. If it's anything you've ever been interested in, you will find yourself on that site for hours just absorbing all that is Amityville. There you go. It certainly gives you something to think about from the Amityville Horror and the timeline of events and that story as it still continues to evolve to this day with the kids speaking out about it. Just amazing stuff. A while back, we had been communicating with Christopher Quarantino, his brother, about getting him on the show and hopefully talking about this. Still attempting to make that happen. I'll just be completely honest. He was talking with us on Facebook, was really interested in coming on, and then word started getting out that I was hearing that he was working on his own book, and I think that kind of put everything on hold. I think he was, or is, this is just my assumption, I could be completely off, waiting for that to be more prepared before maybe doing more
more media, but it would be great, and we would love to have him on the show at some point in time to talk about his experiences there. I know he's spoken out at some points and times about it, but would love to hear more from him, hopefully on a future episode of Real Ghost Stories Online. Another interview that we did a while back, this is from episode number 14 of Real Ghost Stories Online, is with J. Nathan Couch. He's from my home state of Wisconsin. He's in West Bend, Wisconsin. Actually had the privilege of going on a ghost tour with him around the city of West Bend, Wisconsin last year. And I got to see what I believe was the first, or my first, ghost, actual apparition high above a museum in West Bend, Wisconsin, which I believe used to be a courthouse. We looked up. We were waiting for him to arrive for the tour. We're looking up into the window of the courthouse building, high, high, high up. This is like clock tower, you know, part of the building, not a normal room that anyone or cleaner or anything would be in. And we just saw what looked like a somewhat glowing, transparent figure in a window. And at first I thought it was just the glare from one of the lights that were on the building. But shortly thereafter, it started moving and then just faded off. When he got there, we asked him about it and told him about it and told us that, well, the building, there should be no one in there right now. There's no cleaning. There's nothing like that. But the building is very haunted, and it is part of the tours that he normally gives. And people have reported many times lights going on and off within the building. So it was not extremely out of the question. And later, I believe, in the season when he was giving tours, he let us know that other folks had also began to see this phenomenon as well. He joined us on the show to talk about Goatman, which is kind of, I guess, bordering, some would view, on ghosts. But the interesting thing about Goatman is it's not so much a Bigfoot or a Yeti or anything of that nature. Goatman actually does fall into the ghostly paranormal, because this entity is one that appears and disappears just as a ghost would. It's not like a solid entity or creature that some believe is living in the woods. I guess some may feel that way, but more so than not, this seems like a dark, demonic type thing that has stories all over the country. Some very much in line of an urban legend, some very, very real as far as sightings go. And he wrote a book about Goatman, and he joined us on the show to talk about the legend of the mysterious Goatman. Jay Nathan Couch is working on the book about Goatman, and he is joining us today to talk about where he is on the book, what Goatman is all about. You may have one in your own area or a legend about it, and you may have people who've even seen or have stories about this mysterious character called Goatman. So joining us right now on the phone is J. Nathan Couch to talk to us about Goatman. Let's start at the beginning with Goatman as being, the mythological type character and creature before we get into the stories present day of people seeing. Nathan, what's some of the background on Goatman?
Basically, it's sort of like Bigfoot in that there's all these little regional names for what essentially sounds like the same creature. Some descriptions vary. Some descriptions will say that it's more like a mythological satyr, where it has a human upper half with a goat lower half.
Mm-hmm.
Others say it's furry all over, with, you know, a humanoid form with the goat lower half and a goat's head.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, any site that has one description will generally have the other. They have all these little regional names. Some of the more famous, the most famous version of Goatman is, interestingly enough, just called Goatman out in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is probably the second most well-known Goatman, the Lake Worth Monster in Lake Worth, Texas. And then rounding out the big three, as I like to refer to it, the big three incarnations of the animal or spirit or whatever this thing might be, if it exists, is the Pope Lick Monster, which is named after Pope Lick Creek, and that's in the countryside outside of Louisville, Kentucky.
What ties all these together, I'm assuming, is the head. Is it looking like a goat head? Is that accurate?
Yeah, again, it varies depending on the storyteller or the witness, depending on whether or not we're talking about a legend or an actual witness sighting. But generally, sometimes the animal is just, sometimes it's just a man with like a long beard and horns, sort of like a mythological satyr. But more often than not, it does have more of like a weird hybrid combination of a human and a goat's face.
Now, when I hear that, what comes to my mind and what makes it seem different than a Bigfoot or something like that is when you hear of figures or entities that people see that have a figure like that, more often than not, if they're not thinking Goatman or Bigfoot, they're thinking demonic type entity or force. And that's almost what I'm wondering here about Goatman, is if it's falling into the realm of that more than anything else. Before we get into some of the more present day people saying that they've seen this and eyewitness accounts, can you take us back a little bit further? Do you have any idea where or when the idea of the goat man started?
That's a very tough question. It's one that I'm really trying to get to the bottom of as I research the book. A lot of armchair urban legend enthusiasts claim that the goat man began in Maryland, in Prince George's County, which is where the more famous incarnation of the monster or the spirit or whatever this is resides. And a lot of them think that, well, as the internet came along or as people moved from this place to that place, the story kind of traveled with them and it spread to all over the country. And the goat man, wouldn't be surprised if every town ended up having some type of goat man.
It's
legend.
Like, hey, you got a goat man? We got a goat man. Everybody's got a goat man. He'll be like walking down the road in the Christmas parade.
Exactly.
What goat man makes me think of, too, when I hear goat man and that image that's on your website at WashingtonCountyParanormal.com, I'm thinking of Krampus. Because he kind of has that that creepy look to him, like the Krampus character does.
Oh, yes. And just a quick plug, that image was created by Mental Shed Studios, who designed my website.
Okay.
Just so credit is given where credit is due for that.
Sure.
That is an amazing graphic, and they whipped that up in seconds. They're really amazing over at Mental Shed. But as I'm going back in further into my research, or rather getting more into my research, I'm starting to learn that it seems like all of these Goatman legends seem to have started circulating at around the same time. Because, for instance, the Lake Worth Monster out in Lake Worth, Texas, that creature made his big debut in the summer of 1969, whereas the first known mention of the Goatman by name in a Maryland newspaper was in the Prince George's County News in, I believe it was 1971. So it seems as if the idea it already existed here prior to Maryland. And then there's a lesser-known Goatman who is known as the Beast of Billywack, who is in a small town out in Southern California, out in the middle of the desert. And I believe in as early as 1964, the Los Angeles Times featured a story about a renter having to hold off a posse of kids with a shotgun because they were coming onto her property hunting this monster. So it seems like most of these stories all seem to take, you know, the monster seemed to appear around the same time in the 1960s into the early 1970s. And so far, they seem to have developed at least superficially independently of one another.
Okay, very interesting. Now, present day, people have, I want to say legitimate accounts, or as legitimate as an account you can get for seeing such an entity. We don't really want to, like, judge anyone on this show. It's just with something like this where it almost falls into that Bigfoot area, you almost wonder, okay, what exactly is going on here? What are some of those accounts from across the country? What have people seen? What sort of situations were they in? Can you speak to any of that?
Well, the vast majority of sightings that I have found so far seem to resemble a Sasquatch-type animal or mm-hmm. Bigfoot-like animal, some type of human-ape hybrid type thing. A lot of Bigfoot researchers tend to think that it's an instance where, if Bigfoot really do exist, of course, for this to work, you have to be a believer in Bigfoot. That these animals, these Bigfoots, are coming into areas with a pre-existing legend where people already say, well, the goat man works here. Mm-hmm. My high school friend told me that night we were drinking that this is where the goat man's at. And then all of a sudden, a Sasquatch stumbles out of the woods, and they see it. They say it's the goat man, and it takes off. For instance, out the Lake Worth Monster. It was described as being a goat man with scales, but it wasn't really described as having hooves so much. It was a very vague description of it initially. And then a man named Alan Plaster took a photograph of this thing, and it looked like a giant, pale-haired ape man. And a lot of people who saw it later just described it as being a large, hairy animal, which is the way most Bigfoot descriptions come from, or rather how most Bigfoot descriptions come across, as I should say. But so there is that, but in almost every location where there is a real belief in Goatman, I am finding one or two instances in each state where someone is reporting an actual satyr-like animal. For instance, there's a goat man. I wouldn't be surprised if every county in Texas had a goat man legend. There's the Lake Worth Monster in Lake Worth, and then in neighboring Dallas, there's the goat man of White Rock Lake. Nick Redfern, the author of Three Men Seeking Monsters and a ton of other amazing cryptozoology books, had a report of a woman who was jogging around White Rock Lake in the, I think it was mid-afternoon, and all of a sudden she was overcome with a sense of panic. She described it as being what she imagined a panic attack would look like, although she herself had never had one. Then she noticed, off to the side, this goat man, horns, goat-like human face, hairy, and it walked toward her out of the woods, smiled, and then vanished in a flash of light. Definitely supernatural type experience.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick Redfern pointed out that this panic attack she described is very interesting because, the Greek god of the wild, Pan, who was essentially part humanoid, part goat, if you woke him up from his nap out in the wild, you would be overcome with an insane terror. You'd just be panic stricken. That word panic actually is derived from Pan.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting thing there.
It almost makes you wonder if it is more paranormal than an actual physical entity.
Yeah.
with stories like that, where you have like someone physically being affected or emotionally being affected before even seeing anything or hearing anything, but actually having something come over them. That's almost, what would you see more so in haunting type situations, not so much a Bigfoot type situation where, oh, well, my God, they're out in the woods, there's a Bigfoot. You don't usually have that rush of anything until you actually see the entity itself.
Exactly. And if the goat man really is, part man, part goat in its appearance,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to, just like a hairy ape-type animal that's being misidentified,
mm-hmm.
Then you really have to think that it does have to be otherworldly in some respect, because there's nothing, to my knowledge, zoologically, that would resemble a hybrid of a man and a goat.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anything like that has been discovered yet. So I think if we really are seeing a part man, part goat, while it may not necessarily be demonic, I think you're going to have to start thinking perhaps this is some type of nature spirit. Perhaps this is some type of, if you want to get really, really out there in your thinking, something from a pocket dimension, something from another reality. I mean, that's hard to swallow, granted. But if these are genuine experiences, and before I would start thinking there really is half man, half goat coming from a pocket dimension, I would have to see one myself. If people really are seeing it, I think definitely you're going to have to go the supernatural route.
What about, have we looked around at how close maybe some nuclear power facilities are to where these sightings have been? I'm trying to just think of all the weird, bizarre possibilities where there could be some sort of weird mutation. And I'm not insinuating a human / goat mutation because of some sort of leak at some power plant. But there's a lot of documentation that's coming out now and testing of showing just how much leakage a lot of our nuclear power plants have going on and have had for quite some time, especially as they age. Now, I don't think there's a lot of data out there as far as how many mutated animals are existing near these facilities, but there's more than what there's more energy out there that has escaped that I think a lot of people have been aware of over the years. So I'm just wondering, any thoughts on that?
Just about any theory you can think of, from the most as logical as you can get when you're thinking about something like Goatman
sure.
to as far-fetched as you can get,
yeah.
that exists. There's so many, even in an area, for instance, just in Prince George's County, Maryland, there are probably 8, 9, I would say maybe even a dozen variations, and those are just the ones I've found. There's everything ranging from an escaped military experiment to a failed genetic experiment to, unfortunately, because you're dealing with a half-man, half-goat, you get to the old punch-in-the-rib kind of bestiality type, blue humor type explanations for where these things come from. And then, but there is one story, one theory about one possible goat man type creature that kind of goes along with pollution, sort of like what you're talking about. For instance, the TNT out in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, that's very famous for being where the Mothman outbreak occurred.
Sure.
Mothman, very famous. But there's also another monster that has been seen in the TNT a couple of times, starting somewhere around the 1990s, possibly the early 2000s. It's called Sheep Squatch. It has a very laughable name. It's kind of became the favorite dirty joke of the cryptozoology community because of its name. But it was recently featured on, I believe, Monsters and Mysteries in America on Destination America. This thing is seen around Kentucky and West Virginia, and it was initially sighted right near the TNT, and it essentially matches a Sasquatch, but with ram horns, all white. And this thing has been seen out in the TNT, and one of the witnesses actually said that it smelled of sulfur. But instead of thinking that was something demonic, because a lot of people say when there's an evil entity around, you can smell sulfur, for instance, this creature was actually... could have smelled that way because the TNT, they used to make gunpowder.
Sure.
And even today, the ponds and the waters in the TNT area have a sulfuric smell because of the pollution that's still there.
Sure. So,
if something's living in the TNT, it's drinking this polluted water, bathing in this polluted water. While the water may not necessarily be what created it, there is a link there between pollution and a sort of a goat man.
This has to be leading you down so many different paths. It's got to be difficult because you're working on a book about the goat man right now. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Well, the book is called Goat Man, Flesh or Folklore. Mm-hmm. And hopefully the book will be done by autumn of this year. I am It's one of those things where I can't tell you what percentage complete I am. Because
sure.
Right when I think that, okay, I've got four goat men left.
Yeah.
That I'm going to talk about. Like last night, I found three new goat men in Texas. I'm constantly like, well, I definitely need to talk about this because this is interesting. There's this path I need to explore. Mm-hmm. But I would say I'm up around 25,000 words right now in the manuscript.
Wow.
And so it's, I don't think it's going to be twice that big, so I'd say I'm more than halfway finished.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like every chapter there's a new avenue to explore. For instance, the people who believe that the goat man is just an urban legend, they believe that it's a Lover's Lane legend, and it's actually an offshoot of the Hook Man legend.
Okay.
Most people are familiar with that one. The couple's making out. They still hear a scratching. Either they drive away and they find a hook stuck to the door from the escaped mental patient, or they go out. Usually the male would go out to investigate, and then he would end up being murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some people believe that Goatman is an offshoot of this legend. There's a lot of similarities between a lot of the stories about Goatman. Hometown, or my current town, I should say, of Washington County, Wisconsin, just outside of West Bend, where I'm living,
mm-hmm.
there's a goat man. And his legend is very similar to the hook man legend, and it even turns out that there was a hook man legend in the exact same area in the 1970s when the goat man legend was going on.
Really?
And and a lot of people theorize that all of these Lover's Lane legends came about because of a series of murders in Texas. Once again, we're brought back to Texas.
Sure.
It seems like all things goat man kind of gravitate toward Texas. But a series of murders in the 1940s, I want to say it was 1946, mm-hmm. but it was sometime in that time frame, called the Moonlight Murders. There was a movie made by Charles B. Pierce about it called The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, this man known as the Phantom, which is what the press dubbed him, would go to Lover's Lanes and murder and these couples and molest the women. And he was actually never caught. And he was the first serial killer in America that's known who would prey on couples who were, you know, being intimate, and in some outdoor place. And a lot of people think that he inspired stories like the Hook Man, which seemed to have originated in the 1950s.
Mm-hmm.
And the Goat Man started, some say the story started in the 50s. The earliest I can find is the early 50s. So some think the Goat Man kind of grew out of all that.
Interesting. I was unaware of the Wisconsin Goatman. I grew up in Fond du Lac, actually. So for those of the folks listening out there, about 20 miles north of West Bend. And I heard all different bizarre stories of things around the state, but never heard of the Goatman. That's very interesting.
Yeah, the Wisconsin Goatman is definitely one of the lesser-known Goatmen.
Mm-hmm.
When I first found out about it, even though I've always had a real passion for strange things, urban legends, the unexplained, all things Fortean, all that sort of thing. When I moved to Wisconsin, and I first heard about the Goat Man, I was convinced that he was unique to this area.
Mm-hmm.
But then, 24 hours later, when I typed it into Google, all of a sudden, here's all these goat men all over the place.
When you first,
some of them have even been featured on television shows.
When you first heard about Goat Man, when you were doing that, I mean, what was your initial reaction to it? I want to ask you what your reaction is to it now that you've done the research. But first off, what was your first thoughts on Goat Man when you first heard the stories?
Well, I was extremely excited because I grew up originally. I was born in Georgia in a very small town. Out in the mountains, very creepy at night. All sorts of stuff was haunted there. There was Bigfoot sightings, all that sort of stuff. And I collected it for my own enjoyment. I was fascinated with it all. I knew where most of the stuff was. And when I moved to Wisconsin, I didn't know hardly any of that stuff, at least not in the area where I was living.
Mm-hmm.
So when I found out something as wild as Goatman existed, I went out that night looking for it. I was so unfamiliar with the area and the the road is not marked very well. It's actually called Hogback Road in Hubertus, which is over by Holy Hill in Washington County. I didn't even find the road, but I was still so excited to know that one day I would find it. And a couple weeks later, I got a map and I did find the location. And, you know, the story, Goat Man is something that, you know, is so terrifying because the Goat Man is almost always murderous. There's only a couple of stories where he isn't at least extremely violent. But he's such an absurd character. Not to say that he's not real, but it's such an absurd thing that it's so outlandish that you don't think it can actually harm you until you actually encountered it, if you ever do. Most people never see the thing when they go looking for it. But it was that fun kind of thrill where you're like, okay, this is, you know, too insane to be real. Let's go look for it.
With real, just kind of enough, almost like you're living in a horror movie and you know eventually it's going to end and you can turn the lights on and eat the rest of your popcorn and watch The Daily Show or something afterwards.
Exactly.
You don't actually feel like you're really going to encounter the Goat Man. Now that you've done all the research and now that you've heard so many stories, all these different encounters of it, how do you feel about the Goat Man now?
It's still one of those things where I'm not going to discount anyone. If somebody emails me, calls me up, you know, sends me a telegram, I'm not going to think, oh, well, this person's on drugs. They're crazy. They have emotional problems. But I'm not going to be able to actually believe that the Goat Man is a real phenomenon because it's so outrageous. I have to experience it for myself. I actually don't ever want to experience it for myself because I believe that if I did see something like the Goat Man, it would be such a startle, so jarring that it could possibly unhinge your grip on reality.
Sure.
It's not something that should exist, but that's why it is so hard to believe. But I take all these things seriously as I find them. Because there's a billion stories out there about small town newspaper journalists who guffaw through the whole thing and make the same bad jokes that I want to take it seriously because no one really ever has. But at the same time, I can't take it so seriously that I can go out there and, you know, go to war for the Goat Man's existence.
There you go. That was our interview with J. Nathan Couch from episode 14 of Real Ghost Stories Online, looking way back 300-some episodes ago on our show. Very interesting talk about those experiences and what he's learned on that topic. And that wraps up today's encore episode of Real Ghost Stories Online, a flashback to some of our favorite interviews from days gone by. If you like the show, please support it. Help keep us on the air. Get access to all 40-some EPP bonus episodes of our show. You can do that by signing up to be an EPP extra podcast person at realghoststoriesonline.com. There's so much great material out there. Excellent stories that are just waiting for you. It's only $5 a month, and it keeps our show alive and on the air. Check it out. Like I said, realghoststoriesonline.com. Until next time, for Jenny Brewski, I'm Tony Brewski. Thanks for listening to another episode of Real Ghost Stories Online.